So what would you say to other men who have experienced the same thing?
The first question, part of it, I think, was luck. My father left when I was about 10. I think the fact that he wasn't there through my teen years helped immeasurably. I think that's one of the reasons that I didn't get beaten, is that he did the sexual abuse, but he didn't start beating people until puberty, really. When they started to say no, then they would get beaten. I was fortunate that way. Another reason that I was able to survive is because the stars, I would go out at night and I would listen to the stars, and the stars told me that what I was experiencing was not natural or inevitable. They saved my life because I knew that there was something wrong with what was going on. I knew that this is not what it's supposed to be like. And I contrast that with my sister, who it wasn't until she was in eighth grade that she learned that not every father rapes every daughter. And so she didn't know that alternatives could exist. It was the stars that told me that. You know, of course, I went through this phase when I was in my early 20s when I thought that I had projected it onto the stars. But then I've come back. And that's one of the things that our whole culture just does sort of systematically, is say there is no alternative. And that's why you get all these books that say that it's inherent for men to rape women, that it's biological. And they're not doing this. It's not like some big conspiracy. It's like my friend George says, you don't have to have a conspiracy when everybody thinks the same. If hope can be eliminated, and there's a big difference between false and real hope, but if hope can be eliminated, then you don't even have to beat them anymore. That's why there aren't any alternatives to industrial capitalism. That's why we have to know that there aren't alternatives. That's why it's inevitable. That's why nature is red in tooth and claw. That's why we're told that everything's competition. So somehow I got spun out from that. When I knew that there could be, it was not somehow, it was the stars told me that there were other ways. And I held on to that. And the other thing that kept me alive through all the amnesia is even though the beatings were routine, you know, like I said, and like I said there, you know, we forget every day. I held on to, for all my life, specific images. Because my father was saying every day, no, I'm not touching, I'm not beating anybody. And there were specific images that I held on to as if my life depended on it, because I knew it did. Since we, of course, in the family didn't talk about it, you know, and I didn't talk, the sister that I have a good relationship with now, we actually didn't talk for a bunch of years. She was married to an abuser. So we've started talking. It's been wonderful at this point to deconstruct. It's like, so wait a second, I remember this time. Is that how you remember it? So that was the first part. What was your second question?
What kind of advice would you have on
I think all you can do for anybody is provide support. You obviously can't force somebody to talk about something they don't want to talk about. You know, it's just a re-traumatization. I think, actually, I may be able to do something that you can't in this circumstance, which is to provide an example of a male who talked about it and didn't die. So I think that there are some places, probably, that I can go, or that another male could go, that you can't. And this is sort of a generic rule. I mean, there are some things that I can talk to my students about at the prison, but there are other things that only somebody who'd been in prison could talk to them about. I can talk to women as a survivor of rape, but I can't talk to women as a survivor of systematic oppression. So there are places that maybe another male could go that you can't. I mean, that's kind of a cop-out. I don't know.
Where would you be if you hadn't talked about it?
Dead. I would be dead I have Crohn's disease. It's an incurable progressive illness of the intestines. So it's kind of cool because it's a disease of industrial civilization, so I can literally say that industrial civilization is eating away at my guts. Two things I have to do these days to make sure I don't get it. One is I don't get flare-ups. I've had very bad flare-ups before, and I'm doing pretty well these days. One is to make sure I get enough sleep, and the other is to make sure I'm not in a really bad relationship. And it's pretty clear also, you know, that the survivors who do the best are the ones who have the survivor mission. Mythologies of all times and all places have said that if you go into the abyss and then you come back and you bring back a gift to the community. Judith Herman talks about this, that you can't transcend abuse. You can't transcend the atrocity. What you can do is you can turn it into a gift to the community. You can take the things that you've learned from it and give it back.
Process and coming back from being a survivor of that. The other thing I was thinking about is where your relationship is at with your family right now. I'm curious to know if your dad is around or if you have a viable relationship with him?
I have a really good relationship with my mom. We process this stuff to death, actually. And that's why we can have a good relationship, is we've been really honest about it. I have a relationship with one sister, and I don't have a relationship with my other siblings. And my father, I don't have a relationship with, in great measure, because he hasn't changed. A couple years ago, he sent me a check for 150 bucks and a card that said, "Let's let the past be past." And so I turned the check over to a battered women's shelter. I've wondered what it would take for reconciliation, especially because I was raised a Christian, and I got all this honor your father and mother bullshit when I was a kid. Everybody kept saying, you gotta forgive him. So I thought a lot about forgiveness, and part of the deal is that there has to be a change before there can be forgiveness. If somebody's still perpetuating the behavior, and what I know from my siblings is he hasn't changed. Although the healing thing, I think the first most important thing is for a person to find safety. Physical safety, obviously, first, and then emotional safety. Find a place where they aren't in danger of being put in double binds or whatever. And then eventually, I think the story starts to emerge. In the body. Okay, for years I'd have these terrible nightmares. I would sleep with the clothes hamper in front of the door, and I'd check the room every night before I went to bed. And I would wake up 10, 15 times a night, terrified, turn on the light. I could never sleep. I mean, it would take me literally hours to get to sleep every night. That has changed since writing the book. Telling the story and making meaning of the suffering itself has engendered healing. I used to have nightmares probably 2 or 3 times a night. I have a nightmare maybe once every 6 months. For me, it all came through telling that story. It's like the story wanted to be told through the nightmares, through everything else, through various forms of acting out. That only happens now when I'm under stress. Oh, and here's another thing, and I'm sure you know this yourself, that, God, when I started writing this book, the nightmares increased. They were so bad. They went from just being scary to being so bad that I couldn't get to sleep before dawn. But half the time I wrote this book, I couldn't sleep because they were so bad. I just knew I had to keep going. I would have had various other pressures. I don't know if I could have gone all the way through the process. I'm a big believer in death and rebirth. You know, you've got to sort of dive down into stuff and really muck around in it and then collapse and then come out a different person. And I'm also a believer that that can't be, it's like the old joke about how many therapists does it take to change a light bulb? None. The light bulb has to want to change on its own. I couldn't have written this book 10 years before. It had to be time.
I just wonder if we have a see a lot of people that want to get into the recovery center that I'm working at that aren't getting treatment that I think are carrying around pretty horrific past.
You know, 25% of all women in this culture have been raped in their lifetime. Another 19% fend off rape attempts. And those figures are probably low. 565,000 American children are killed or injured by their parents or guardians each year. So we have a hell of a lot of walking wounded. All those walking wounded end up wounding other people. God knows what damage I passed on in my 20s before I started working on my own stuff. It multiplies. It's like a friend of mine says, at what point does something become normal? If 44% of the women have had someone attempt to rape them, at what point does that simply become part of normal existence? I need to say also that not all cultures are this way. This is not a human thing. The point is that at this point, we're all refugees. I'm a refugee from my childhood. We're all a refugee from school. We're all refugees. You know, none of us will ever know what it would be like to experience a fully functioning community because we don't have them. And what's happened to every functioning community that our culture has ever encountered is destroyed it. And none of us will ever have an encounter with a non-human that is, it's like, you know, everybody always, every anthropological study that we do at this point is bullshit. And every study we do of non-human is bullshit too, because think about it for a second. If they did some sociological study of Russian peasants fleeing the Nazi troops in World War II, what would that say about normal, unstressed human behavior? Almost nothing. So why do we think that the studies we do of non-humans, as we systematically destroy their homes and destroy their lives, why do we think that they're going to treat us the same way they did a long time ago? You know, you hear all these stories. Oh, this great story. Sand Creek Massacre, Colorado. God, I just learned like 2 weeks ago, there was a big massacre up outside of Crescent City. I'm at Yontaket. I've lived there for a couple years, and I've never heard that before. It's everywhere. You look anywhere, and there's going to be a massacre of the Indians. Anyway, Sand Creek Massacre, afterwards, there are these women who were lost, afraid, and they didn't know what to do, and they were hiding out in this little cave, and a wolf came up to them and slept next to them. And at first they were really scared, but then they realized the wolf was keeping them warm. Started walking, and the wolf would stay with them for several days. They started getting hungry, and they said, "Can you help us?" And the wolf led them to a buffalo kill. They ate, and eventually the wolf led them to another Cheyenne village, ate something, and left. And I told this to a scientist friend of mine who said, "Well, that's a really nice fairy tale." That's in the form of silencing. You know, the witnesses were not scientists, so of course it couldn't have happened. Who's to say that that's not how wolves treated humans before humans start, before white humans started killing them? I don't think that that would have been my direction, because I had that fear. I remember seeing this commercial on television when I was 7 or 8 or 9, and it was all these guys in prison, and then the caption was something about 80% of these guys were abused as children. This was supposed to scare abusers into not abusing their kids, but what it did is, oh my God, I'm gonna go to prison. I did not want to become like my father, so my specific direction is I shut down emotions. I saw the effect that my father's violence had, so I vowed never to become angry. After he would beat somebody, he would say, I love you. So I told my mom when I was in about fifth grade that I couldn't tell her I love you anymore. I shut everything down in that direction. I didn't feel for 10 years. And it's kind of cool because I was a high jumper in college. I never used to swear before I became a high jumper. I was amazed at stuff that would come out of my mouth when I was jumping. I started throwing tantrums. If I missed an important jump, I'd kick the back of my shoe off, and then I'd kick it as far as I could. If it was practice, I'd knock the standards over, and my coach used to come over and just put his arm around me and say, real athletes don't need to do that. But what he didn't know is I was so happy to be showing any emotion at all, no matter how unseemly. It's like, oh my God, I can feel. This is the coolest thing in the world. Another way to put this is that, and this is a gross oversimplification, but I've heard it said that abuse survivors usually turn the abuse one of two directions. They either turn it outward or inward. My direction was inward. I've hurt myself more than other people because I was not going to hurt others. I saw the damage that did. And of course, I went so far the other direction, I ended up hurting people still because you're being so tightly controlled yourself.
Was it about writing as opposed to something else, as opposed to another art form?
Because I can't draw worth a darn. Yes, that's how my mind goes.
If you'd not been able to write, you could have approached everything differently.
Well, if I would have been able to write, I would have really wanted to be an outfielder for a major league team. That's the direction I would have wanted to go. If I could live 100 times, I think I'd want to go for baseball in one or two of them. I think it's a great question, and one that I would like to hear your answer to. For myself, a lot of it comes down to discourse. I have a friend who says that most environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a piece of ground, and they end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. For me, frankly, it was two things. One is, as a child, I realized, you know, I was asking the same question I asked in Listening to the Land. I was asking the same question as a kid. If my father's behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? So that's part of the reason I ended up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. And the other big reason is because I was too lazy to get a regular job. I didn't want to work 9 to 5. I couldn't see myself spending the rest of my life doing that. So I started trying to figure out how I guess, I'm lazy, it's probably the wrong word, because God, I became a commercial beekeeper, which is really hard work. But I wasn't going to work for somebody else. It doesn't matter where you start, you're going to end up at the same place if you talk about it. So I think the important thing is to just start asking the questions and also to confront the issues whenever possible. I have a friend who runs the Battered Women's Program for the state of New York, and she's so cool. What she does is she asks every man she meets, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? I've been with her. She gets in a taxi and she asks the taxi driver. She gets on the subway, she asks the person sitting next to her. She's relentless. That's what it is. It's just, I think, bringing it to awareness again and again and raising awareness all the time. I don't have a magic bullet for that one. But I got to say this too, that frankly, I've never seen so many pigs as in environmental organizations. Oh my God. So many of the guys are just way over the top patriarch crap. So, I mean, don't even get me started there. And I had a friend, a female friend, who used to volunteer for Rape Crisis Center in Seattle, and she quit because they treated her like shit. There's a tremendous drain of man and woman power within all these movements because so many of the volunteers are just treated like crap.